Hello. In this audio snippet, we are going to talk a little bit about the foundational pillars that the new American Constitution is to have. And I know that some of the points we shall be discussing here are may sound a little bit esoteric, and I've been struggling in my mind to on the best way to describe these concepts without them seeming so irrelevant or impractical. But I hope that that at the end of this audio snippet, you will see how each of these pillars is fundamental, and it has very practical, each pillar has very practical and real life applications and relevance. So we'll go through these 10 pillars, I don't know if we'll be able to do that all in one snippet, but we'll give it a try. The first five pillars are related to how authority is to be defined, how authority and law are to be defined. And then the second set of five pillars define the five rights of the individual, the rights that authority and the law are intended to protect and defend. And we have briefly mentioned what those five individual rights are, but we'll hopefully go into a little more detail on each right. But first, let's start with the five pillars that define what true authority is. Now, the first pillar would more or less be summarized as saying something like, true authority exists. It's independent of us, and it transcends any person or institution that we can see with our natural eye. So it's basically stating the existence of true authority. Now, someone may say, "Oh, that's such a foolish pillar. Obviously, authority exists," but it's not as foolish or trivial as it may seem. And the reason for that is that the Constitution needs to establish that it is based on this idea that there is a true authority out there, that it's not an authority that we can fashion to our own convenience or to our own taste or preference. It is something independent of us, and that we are to submit to that authority, whatever that authority is or looks like. And that concept, that awareness of authority as this reality that we are to submit to, is something that certain races have been able to comprehend better than others. And it has been so it's been kind of crucial in defining how successful each race has been throughout history. And I would dare say that, and I hope that this does not sound like a comment made out of ignorance. It's a comment derived from observation over a long period of time of different people and how they behave and how they act and how they think. And I would dare say from all that observation that for better or for worse, however you want to take this, that the white race has proved to be over time the one that had this greatest awareness of the existence of authority and the need to submit to it and respect it. And it's something that other races do not have. And I'll just give you an example. And this is the example that I point out because of the observations that I have made throughout my life and the experiences that I have lived. That if I had to pick a race that clearly shows a certain a blatant unawareness of this pillar, this concept of this existence of an authority that's out there that needs to be respected and submitted to. If I had to pick a race that does not uphold that pillar, I'd have to pick the race or ethnicity, I'd have to pick Hispanic people. Hispanic people have shown to me throughout the, my experience and my interaction with them, that as a people, they have very low regard for authority, and they only respect, and I would say that in quotes, someone if they see that they can punish them in a very severe way. So in other words, if they see the person having power and enough power to punish them for not obeying what they're saying, if that's what, if they see that, then they respect. But if they don't see that power behind that authority, then they are willing to go as far as they can and get away with as much as they can until they are stopped. And that's the reason why, if you look through Latin American history, it's littered with one coup d'etat after another. And whenever one person would overthrow another, then they would instate themselves as dictators for a long period of time until someone gathered enough power to overthrow them and then be the next dictator. You can just take a quick example in Cuba. There was this guy called Batista who was the dictator of the island of Cuba for, I think it was 13 or 14 years. There was this son of a bitch who rose up called Fidelito Castro. And this bastard boy started telling everyone, hey, this man is a dictator. He's abusing power. He's been there for 13, 14 years. It's time to overthrow him. And he gathered enough idiots to go to follow him, and he was able to produce a movement that eventually overthrew Batista, Fulgencio Batista, I think his name was, and he established himself as the new president of Cuba. And as we all know, he took over in 1959. And the little bastard boy stayed there for like 40, 50 years and until he passed away. And now his bastard boy brother is the one in charge, supposedly. So he was criticizing Batista for being in power for 14 years, and he stayed around for 40, 50 years and left the thing to his brother as if it was some sort of a kingdom. And that's just an example, and you can go country after country in Latin America and see the same pattern, where it's the law of the jungle. Whoever can gather more power can control other people and tell them what they can or cannot do, and they become the law, they become the authority. So it is all based on who has power. So and I'm not saying that every Hispanic person acts like this, but I'm talking about the general patterns. There are certain values that are cultivated in certain cultures, in this case the Hispanic culture, that lead to certain patterns of behavior that may be more extreme or less extreme based on individual cases, but there is a pattern nonetheless, and it's undeniable. And I dare say that the vast majority of Hispanic people I've encountered manifest what I'm saying to a greater or lesser extent. So it's a pattern of not respecting invisible barriers. And I'll just give you a quick example here in America we have crosswalks just like they have them in every country, I would dare say, crosswalks or zebra crossings or however you want to call them. And I've noticed, at least here in the New York, New Jersey area, of the United States, that for the most part, whenever I see a car disrespecting the crosswalk, you know, the light is red, they're waiting for the green light, when I see a car that's on top of the crosswalk, you know, not respecting the space that has been allocated for pedestrians to cross, the vast majority of the time, it's a Hispanic. Sometimes it's black people, but the Hispanics have shown this great tendency to say, I don't care. If I don't see a cop anywhere, I will place my car on top of the crosswalk. And yes, I'll leave a little bit of space for the pedestrians to cross and get around my car, but I really, pardon my French, They practically say to themselves, I don't give a damn. As long as I don't get ticketed for this, I'll do whatever I want. And when you confront them, they get very belligerent. And I've had people almost threatening to physically attack me when I have confronted them and told them, hey, respect the crosswalk. They get really, really upset at someone telling them, especially if they don't see that the person is manifesting any sort of power. They don't see a gun, or they see a person who's not physically tall and impressive, not, you know, let's just say 6'8" and 280 pounds. If they see a person that they feel they can physically overcome, they become very belligerent. They don't like being told what to do because they have no respect in the culture, an inherent respect for authority. They need to see more power in the other person, and then they submit like cowards. But if they don't see that power, they don't respect it. They don't have this awareness of this first pillar. And that's something that that white people have much more than other races on the face of the earth. And that's why white people don't get in trouble with police officers as much as, let's say, black people do. Because the black culture, which has issues different from the Hispanic culture, also has a problem with respecting authority. And we will have a hopefully an audio snippet discussing the issues, the cultural issues in black America, and why black America has become what it has become to this day. Because there are certain cultural issues embedded in them that no one talks about because everyone is so concerned about being called a racist that no one really addresses them. And I've always said, if I'm my brother's keeper, I'm going to tell my brother what's wrong with him if that's going to help him to change. And if he doesn't want to accept it, then he ain't my brother no more. And I really couldn't care less what he thinks anymore if he doesn't want to listen. You know, it's just like a family that has a brother that has a drug addiction. And they, you know, I'm sure you've heard of all these interventions where families decide to corral the addict, their addict family member in some house and kind of confront them about their lives and trying to get them to change. Because they care about their brother, they're going to tell the brother or the family member, the cousin or uncle or whatever, that the person has a problem and they need to change if they want to improve their lives. So I see it from that perspective. And I don't care if this is labeled racism or not, because that is not, it's actually the exact opposite. It's the fact that I care, that then that's why I'm saying the things I'm saying. So black people have a certain problem, culturally speaking. I'm not saying every black person, but as a general pattern, black people have a certain problem with respecting authority, and it derives from many issues, including the fact that there's generally a lack of a fatherly presence in many young black people's lives that prevents them being aware of authority as something you respect because it deserves to be respected regardless. And that's why they have problems respecting police officers. And then there's also an issue with white police officers where sometimes they they go overboard with their enforcement of that invisible authority they believe in. And that will be a topic for another audio snippet. So there is not just a problem on the black side. There's a problem on the white side. And it just gets exacerbated because these two extremes collide, and that's when problems arise. But the point is that many cultures do not understand and races, because cultures revolve around races. A race of people are together for a period of time, and then they develop a culture, a set of values and principles that the majority of the people in that race or that ethnicity live by. And we'll talk about that in another audio snippet. But the thing is that many cultures do not understand this first pillar. They do not have this inherent awareness that there's an authority that you respect. You don't put your car on top of the crosswalk just because you can. If the light is red, you have to respect that invisible barrier. There's something there that's holding you back, and you're to respect it. It doesn't matter. You don't get to decide how much of the crosswalk you will give away to the pedestrians. It has already been established. This is the space, and you respect it. you know, obviously there's some sort of extenuating circumstance, then yes, you have to give a little bit of room for, you know, quote, violations of that invisible barrier. Like, for example, there's a police, there's an ambulance that needs to get through, and you have to kind of step into the crosswalk a little bit to give room for the ambulance behind you to keep going. So yeah, obviously there are exceptions, but there's this invisible barrier, and you respect it because authority is there. It doesn't matter if there's a police officer there or not. It doesn't matter if there's a camera recording what you're doing. You respect that invisible barrier because it deserves to be respected. And that's a problem that the Hispanic culture doesn't have. And that's why Hispanics just cross the border into the United States so callously. They couldn't care less. If they can do it, they will do it. And they will blame you for getting away with it, for them getting away with it, as if to say, why did you let us do it? It's your fault. It's like someone saying, hey, I broke into your house and stole all that stuff because you left the door open. It's your fault. So there's this disrespect in the Hispanic culture and in many other cultures, but in particular the Hispanic culture, this disrespect of invisible barriers. So the first pillar kind of emphasizes this awareness of this invisible concept or reality of authority, and that it transcends persons or institutions. It's not there because there's a cop there. It's not there because there's an organization deciding that this is the right thing to do. It's there because it's there, and you are to honor it and respect it. So that's the first pillar. And this first pillar is very important from another perspective, in that it redefines the way that the rest of the Constitution, the rest of the document, will be written up. And what do I mean by that? The current Constitution in the United States was written by founding fathers who sat down and said, okay, we need something that's workable, and let's just write this up. And if it kind of is workable and looks fine and we can live with it, then it's okay. Then we're going to live with this, and this is going to be our form of government. It's as if they took this bunch of clay or whatever and started molding a government. And as long as the government seemed to fit more or less what they wanted, what was convenient, what was more or less a workable system, it was okay. So they just kind of put together this statue and fashioned it in a way that they saw fit. And they said, we'll run with it. So in a sense, their attitude was, we will define what true authority is. And once we define it, that's what it is. Everyone who's followed after that, especially, you know, conservatives and those who worship the founding fathers, look back and say, hey, that's authority. That's how government should be. What the founding fathers said, that's the way true government is to be defined. That's the perfect form of government. Why? Because they defined it as such, and then we're just following their definition. So, and that's why federalism, it fits so well into the founding fathers' mindset and into our current mess of a system. Because in federalism, you're saying to each state, oh, hey, you define your own statute. Just take your lump of clay and, you know, mold it the way you want. And you, the other state, you do the same thing. And we'll have 50 different statutes, 50 different ways that people define what true government and true authority looks like. And as long as it works for you, that's fine. We couldn't care less. You know, you do your thing, and that's why it federalism fits so perfectly, because the mindset is we are defining what authority is, and this first pillar that we're talking about says no. We are not defining what true authority is. We are supposed to describe it. It's like this is not freelancing. This is not a night at the improv. it's not that we're taking a lump of clay and saying, what do you want authorities to look like? Oh, I think I want to have to, you know, have three arms and four eyes and five ears. And it's not you deciding what it's going to be like. You're like, you know, like a sculptor who is looking at a model who is independent, who's outside of you. And you're looking at it, and as you're looking at it, you're molding the statue, trying to make it look exactly like the external model that you are using. It's like in someone painting a portrait. Let's say that you sit down with someone, you know, and you pay them a certain amount of money, and you want them to kind of do a portrait of you. You know, like people on the street sometimes, you know, they sit there, someone comes along and says, okay, you know, $10 and I'll do a portrait of you. And the person sits there in front of the guy, and the guy starts, you know, doodling and doing his thing. And then say after 10, 15 minutes, he says, I'm done. If he comes and shows it to you, and you look at it, and it looks more like a Picasso, you know, representation of you, a Cubist representation that looks nothing like you, you're going to be mad. You're going to be angry that you had to sit there for 10 minutes for him to come up with this stupidity. And you would say, hey, I'm not going to pay you. You do that again because it has to look like me. That doesn't look like me at all. I don't know what that is. So that's how we should be writing the Constitution. Under this concept of this first pillar, our attitude is, okay, we are here to describe something that exists independently of us. It's out there. We don't know exactly what it is, but we're making an effort to define it, to portray it, to draw it out, to look exactly as it is outside of us. And just like the guy doing the portrait, if he, you know, if the person says, hey, you made my nose too long or too big, can you change that? Then the guy, you know, has the responsibility to kind of erase the nose and do it again until it looks exactly like the person's nose. So that means that we are recognizing that, hey, we may not be getting it right on the first draft, but as we observe and see what's going on, we'll say, oh, yeah, this is right. The nose is right. Or no, the nose is too long, so we're going to have to change the law here or change this part of the Constitution or whatever or of the system so that it finally works. And so it completely changes. This first pillar, inane and silly as it sounds, it just changes the whole perspective of how the rest of the document is written out. It makes us aware that we are describing something independently of us that exists, even if we don't define it. And that's very important. True authority exists, even if no constitution is ever written to describe it to perfection. It's still there, and we're still accountable to that true authority, to live our lives by that authority and by the laws that emanate from that type of true authority. It's just a matter of us as humans discovering that true authority and laying out the laws that fit what that true authority is like. So that's pillar number one. So let's go now to pillar number two. Pillar number two is can be described as saying this true authority, you know, from pillar number one, is not to be permanently or completely linked to anything that is temporal or visible. In other words, we're not to attach this true authority to any one person. That's what happens with dictatorships. You know, they believe there's a true authority, and then they look at a dictator, a leader, a Führer, and they say, okay, we'll take this authority and ascribe it to this one person. This one person is true authority, and whatever he says or she says goes. That's what true authority is. That's what pillar number two say. You can't do that, or say, this is associated to this one institution. and whatever this institution says and declares, that is true authority. No, no. You cannot associate it to anything temporal. You cannot ascribe this true authority to anything that's temporal or visible, to any person or institution. Because if you do that, then you are temporalizing it, you are reducing it to something ephemeral and capricious that can change. And it's not tied to something beyond our visible understanding, if you know what I mean. So that's pillar number two. So that means that I'm not going to say, I am not obligated to submit to a person or an institution regardless. I am to submit to that person or institution if they are in accordance with what true authority is. And if not, then I'm not morally obligated to submit to them. I'm not going to unconditionally give myself over to these authorities. It's like what's happening at the time of this recording with the masks and all this nonsense that's going on with the pandemic. That people are saying, oh, what the CDC, you know, like here in the U.S., what the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, you know, says, that's what it is. If they say you can only stand 72 inches away from each other, and if you get, you know, within 71 inches, then you're violating some holy tenet and you're evil, then, you know, so, and if they change it the next day, if the CDC says, oh, now you can, you know, get within 36 inches of somebody else, then, oh, yeah, it's okay now. And this blind following like sheep of whatever this institution says, that's contrary to this pillar. Pillar number two says there's a true authority, yes, but you cannot ascribe it or associate it or link it permanently to a person or an institution. Or anything visible or temporal, because all these things are capricious. They can change. The people at the CDC could be motivated by something that has nothing to do with people's health, which is the case in the United States right now. And that's why you have Tony Fauci saying one day masks are unnecessary. Remember at the beginning he was saying that masks are necessary because they don't work with flu-like viruses. Why? Because he was speaking out of the science he knew. You know, corrupt as he was still saying what his scientific awareness was, because studies have been done over the last, you know, prior to all of this, over a period of 10, 15 years, studies had been done, and every time it kept coming out, masks are not effective against flu-like viruses. And it's just out of the basic principle that masks, the holes in them are 50 to 100 times larger than the size of virus particles like the flu or like you know, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So in order for a mask to be really be effective, it has to be so airtight that you wouldn't be able to breathe and you choke to death. So they are not effective and they cause other health issues. So he was saying, based on the science at the very beginning, hey, masks are just for show. It makes you feel good, makes you feel protected, but it really doesn't do anything. And then the politicians got to him and convinced him, hey, you have to say masks are necessary because we need people to be afraid, and we have certain plans ahead for the election. And at the end, so he changed his tune. So that's why what I mean by capriciousness. If you base your acceptance of what is true or what is not true on a single person, that person can change. You're subject to the whims of that person's will, and true authority is not subject to whims. It is transcendental. So that's pillar number two. And now pillar number three would be that authority cannot be used, true authority in its real form, pure form, cannot be used to achieve any vain purposes. It cannot be used in vain to achieve, say, personal or self-centered ends. That means that if someone is exercising so-called authority and is using it to make himself rich and more powerful, then that person is not operating in true authority. you know, just like, for example, here in the U.S., this whore, this bitch called Pelosi, who's been the so-called Speaker of the House. And thank you, Founding Fathers, for creating the Speaker of the House office, which has led to so many problems. And now we have a whore occupying that office that the Founding Fathers stupidly created. This woman has been in Washington forever. And she and her husband are millionaires, and it's been known that the husband does a lot of dealings and tradings and stuff that are intricately related to laws that are being passed in Washington under the influence of his wife. And like recently, there was this headline about a stock that Pelosi's husband sold off. Right before a certain law was passed, and after the law was passed, the stock tanked, and the guy made a lot of money on, you know, by selling the stock at this high value before it collapsed. And time after time, you know, they do this, and that's why they become so rich. Just like that, this whore, and I don't know if this son of a bitch is alive or dead. Harry Reid, who was the Senate Majority Leader when, oh bastard, that little primate was soiling the White House, you know, for 8 years. Harry Reid was the Senate Majority Leader, and he was a very wealthy man living on a senator's salary. And I know they make too much money, and we'll talk about that in some other audio snippet about the restrictions on their salaries, and that will emanate from this pillar. But, you know, on that, even though a senator makes more than what they should be making, it was still not enough to justify the wealth that this man had. And no one ever investigated him. No one ever looked into it. But that's a clear violation of this pillar, that you cannot use authority. And he made this all this money because he was doing all this behind the scenes dealing, using his power in the Senate to, you know, benefit certain people, and certain people would benefit him, and so forth. So all this corruption is from using authority for vain purposes, using it in vain to achieve goals that are personal and self-centered. That's a very simple pillar, but it has to be declared as one of the basic tenets of the new American Constitution. And pillar number four would be that it's kind of difficult to describe, but I would call it the contemplation pillar. And it's basically the idea that to know the true laws that emanate from this true authority that we know exists from pillar number one, from accepting pillar number one. To know the true laws that emanate from true authority requires occasional and deliberate detachment from the temporal. In other words, it requires a contemplation and evaluation of what's being achieved. You have to kind of get away from the routine and step back and analyze and see, okay, we established these laws, these principles, these rules. Are they working? Are they in accordance? Are they producing fruits that are consistent with what true authority looks like, or we would think would look like? And this pillar, for example, has very clear, very practical applications. Like, for example, with all this mandates stuff that has been going on at the time of this recording with the virus, if they had been sincere, obviously they always had an ulterior motive. But let's just for one moment assume in this fantasy world that these people actually care. Cared about people's health. Let's assume this. I know this is a big fantasy, but let's just fantasize for 1 second that these politicians actually care for people's health, and that they were putting in these laws because they wanted to stop the virus and they didn't want people to die, blah, 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 blah. If that had been the case, then they would have analyzed, they would have imposed these stupid mandates about the 72 inches or 2 meter distancing and all this other work stoppage and all that. And then they would have come back and seen the data, and they would have seen, hey, all are lost, and they would have maybe compared with what happened in different countries. You know, different countries enacted different levels of mandates and enforcements, and they would have seen there is no correlation in the data between the mandates and the progression of the disease. So they would have analyzed that, oh, this is not working, we have to do things differently. And they would have gone back and revised it and said, okay, oh yeah, we should be aiming towards herd immunity, kind of what Sweden and Denmark and other countries were doing, and we would have been on a much different path. And they would have also seen, for example, that they've gone and seen, okay, we're not dealing with the symptoms. We're trying to control the contagion, but we're not the spread of the virus, but we're not dealing with the symptoms. How do we deal with the symptoms better? Ventilators are not working. They would have seen the data. People are dying more quickly with the ventilators and all that. They would say, okay, then is there any solution out there? Oh, yeah, there's hydroxychloroquine. There's ivermectin. And they would have seen the history of these drugs that are safe and cheap. And they would have said, okay, let's try it with these people and see if it works. Oh, it's working because, you know, the medicine does work. And the studies have shown time after time they work. And the only times that these medicines have not worked is when they have deliberately done a study where they overdosed people with the drug just to make it fail on purpose. But studies that have been done in the past and studies, you know, in the present that have been, you know, medically objective and medically sincere about finding the truth have proved time and again that it works. And we see the anecdotal examples in India and in other countries where Indonesia and all these places where these medicines are being used and they are taming the disease completely. And it's working. So if they had this attitude of contemplation and observation and kind of detaching, let's stop making laws for a second. Let's analyze and see what's going on. Is it working? Is it not working? Then they would have said, okay, yeah, we need to make adjustments. That's pillar number four, this fact that to arrive at true authority, we need to be getting away from the routine, kind of going on a sabbatical in a sense. And analyze for a brief period of time what our laws are doing, and if there's something in the system that seems to be problematic, and if so, then we have to go and fix it. You know, it's part of this. It's related to the first pillar in the sense that we're aware that we have to reach a perfection, a certain true authority that's out there, and we're trying to draw this true authority in this portrait called the Constitution. And if we're not getting it right, then we have to go and fix the nose, fix the ear, or whatever we're getting wrong from this person, this entity that we are portraying in the Constitution. So that's pillar number four, and I'd call it maybe the contemplation and observation pillar. And that's very, very important. So it kind of gives us this openness that as we're writing the Constitution, we will be having to go back sometimes and correct a few things along the way. But we can't just be etching everything in stone and saying, this is it, this is it, this is it, and pretend like we never have to go back and revisit things. Because sometimes we do get it right, we just need to add more depth to it. And that doesn't mean that, so even if we're getting everything perfect, you know, as we're writing it out, there will be times where we go, oh, we need to go deeper into this. So we need to dig deeper and write out more details, more, or we missed something. We kind of got general idea, but there was something deeper here that we needed to kind of emphasize. So we need to add something in the Constitution for this and so forth. So that's pillar number four. Pillar number five is that it seems to contradict pillar number one. But it's sort of a balance that that needs to be maintained. It doesn't deny pillar number one. It just, in fact, makes it stronger. And pillar number five would be that even though we understand that true authority transcends what we, you know, can see with our natural eye, transcends any person or institution, we still have to recognize that it has temporal manifestations. So even though we're saying, oh yeah, true authority exists, it's this invisible concept out there that we are to submit to and respect, then we could go to the extreme and say, hey, you know, I am not going to listen to no man. I'm not going to be bound by any law, by any Congress or any, you know, as we're calling it in the new constitution, the House of Commons. No, I'll do whatever I feel is right because I am bound to no one but this true authority. That would be a violation of this pillar number five. Yes, even though we do recognize it goes beyond the visible, it can have visible manifestations, and we are to respect the visible manifestations no matter and regardless of their power. So they can be weak and vulnerable, but we'll still respect it. You know, it's like like a son that has a father, and the father maybe is like 70, 80 years old, he's a little frail, and maybe, you know, he's not strong like he used to be, and the son maybe has grown to be this impressive, strong man, and this frail father, but he will still, if he's a good son, will respect his father even at that frail state and that advanced stage. And if the father says, hey, you do something or whatever, he will take that with the same level of respect as if he was a kid or a young person listening to his healthy and strong father. It doesn't matter how strong or weak his father is. There's something about him. He's a father. So he's to be respected and honored, regardless of how much power he has. So it's this awareness that, yes, this authority is invisible, but it has physical manifestations, and we're to respect them regardless of how much power they wield. If a police officer comes and tells me I'm breaking, you know, you shouldn't do this, and he's not wearing any guns on him, he doesn't have a taser, doesn't have a baton to beat me up, but he is a police officer, and he's coming with a legitimate complaint against me, I am to honor and respect him. Even if he was like even if it was a woman, a very short and frail woman coming to tell me that I'm doing something wrong and that I should correct it or she will put me in jail, I will respect and honor her. Frail, and even though I could overpower her and even kill her or whatever, and no one would know because no one else would be witnessing it, none of that would matter because I'm still to honor that tangible manifestation of authority. I hope that's making sense. That's pillar number five. So we have basically defined the first five pillars of authority. And everything is to emanate from those five pillars in regard to authority. Just as a side note, it's worth kind of emphasizing that as we've been talking about this new American Constitution, that when we draft this document, it's going to be a document from which everything else flows, everything in our legal system flows. The Founding Fathers, when they wrote the current Constitution, didn't think like that. To them, it was more like a replacement of the Articles of Confederation. It was a way to keep the states together, to kind of define some sort of national government and get us going. And they couldn't care less. They were not looking for this perfection of a government. They were just looking for something that works and keeps us together for a while. And that was that. And then it became eternalized. They didn't believe in pillar number one. And then pillar number two came, and we became idolaters of these people and worshiping whatever they fashioned. And whatever they fashioned, that's the perfection. That is how government should look like, because that's what America is all about. And it became eternalized. But they never saw it. And that's why then federalism came in and said, okay, we're not going to worry about all the little details. You know, each state can work it out. You know, they can be their own. And I find that so annoying when they talk about the states being these laboratories where people can experiment their own laws and stuff. Really, do you really think that we have laboratories? Do you think that California is doing some sort of experiment? You know, with an experiment, you are doing it knowing it's temporary, and you're going to analyze the results afterward and then decide if we should continue or not. There's no such thing in California. They're they're diving off the cliff, and instead of saying, hey, we're doing something wrong, they're just trying to go faster towards the cliff. There is no experiment. So all that stuff about, oh, we're experimenting, really, how long will the experiment be? You know, slavery was experiment, right? From that perspective, under federalism, the southern states were experimenting, quote-unquote, with slavery. And they experimented, quote-unquote, for, what, 150, 200 years, I forget how long it was. And they never stopped experimenting. And somebody started saying, hey, I think you should stop that experiment. And they said, hell no. And don't tread on me. And you know, hurrah, the bunny blue flag that bears a single star and all that stuff. And so they rebelled and said, this is no experiment. This is how we want to do things, period, full stop. So whenever you hear that explanation, just laugh it off. It's just stupidity. Going back to the original point, the founding fathers saw the Constitution as this thing just to hold these 13 heterogeneous communities or entities, sovereign entities together. And that was it. But then that's why we got into the mess, because they left so many gaping holes that we've tried to describe in previous clips, that, you know, the whole system began to collapse eventually. But the new Constitution should be this framework where everything emanates from this document. Nothing can exist that cannot be tied in one way or another to some fundament, some principle in the original Constitution. And anything that's in the Constitution itself cannot exist if it cannot be tied directly or be justified by one of these 10 pillars that we're laying out. So it's like this foundational system. It's like the 10 pillars are the postulates. If you've studied geometry, for example, with Euclid, the Euclidean geometry, I think Mr. Euclid came up with, I think it was 23 postulates. These were like things that were accepted without question. So he laid out these 23, or I hope that's the right number, of postulates, and from that, all geometry was built up. Then people started, you know, doing theorems and building on these postulates to produce new truths, you know, that could be proved based on these postulates. So everything that's in Euclidean geometry can eventually be traced back to these original tenets that that Euclid established. So this should be the same with these 10 pillars. Every law, no matter how minuscule, even if it's a small law in the small town in the deepest part of the Appalachian Mountains, it should be traced back to something in the Constitution. And if it cannot be traced back, then there's something dangling, something missing that we have to fix. And just to give you an example of what I'm trying to get across, and this example might seem silly, but it's just to illustrate the point. Let's think about the speed limit. In the United States, in the federal highway system, there's a speed limit of 55 miles per hour, and it used to be higher. I forget what the speed limit was before, but it was eventually reduced to 55. And in real life, most people go over 55. And like in New Jersey, for example, I think you can go 60, 65 miles per hour, and no one will get ticketed. So it's really 55 plus a certain buffer, and I think it might depend on what place you're in. But in general, the idea is you don't go too much over the limit, otherwise you will get ticketed. Like, you can't go 100 miles per hour without drawing attention and being pursued and ticketed if they can catch you. There's this law, and I'm not debating whether the law is valid or not. That's beside the point. But there's this law out there, and the law was intended to save lives. Supposedly, at 55, you save a certain number of lives compared to the previous limit, and that's why they enacted that limit. But I would ask you, okay, there's this law, and it's a federal law, and so you can't hide behind federalism here. Can you, I would ask a conservative, can you explain to me how the Constitution validates that law? And I'm pretty certain that most conservatives would just laugh at me and walk away saying, what is this idiot talking about? Because to them, just making that connection is stupid. But the fact that they think it's stupid, it actually reveals their own stupidity, that they don't understand that either the Constitution is a foundational document or it isn't. You can't have it both ways. If it is foundational, it's the root of everything else that follows from there. So the reality is there is nothing to justify the 55 mile per hour limit based on the Constitution. It's saying, oh, well, yeah, the government, you could kind of make up all these ideas that government can regulate interstate commerce or transportation and this and that. You can try to come up with something, but at the end of the day, you'll just be spinning your wheels. There is no connection. And you know why there really is no connection between that law and the Constitution? Because the Constitution says absolutely nothing or almost nothing about the right to life. And that law is based on the principle that it's intended to save lives, to protect the right to life of citizens. But because the Constitution doesn't even go make a simple effort to define or defend the right to life of people, then that law can never be justified based on the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we should write laws to defend the right to life. And every law, and that's one thing that I don't know if this it has been mentioned before, every law under the New American Constitution has to have in its writing an explanation of what rights it defends. So, if a law is passed, the writers of the law have to say this law is to defend right number three or right number five of the individual, or to uphold pillar number three or uphold pillar number four, of the pillars we've discussed in this audio clip. It has to be very clear. It has to be traced. It has to say it's associated to these pillars of the Constitution, and it's required to do that to force legislators to expose themselves. If they write this is to protect the right to life, and you read the document, you go, this has nothing to do, this is not protecting any life, what are you talking about? Then you know that they're just making stuff up. And so it kind of exposes the legitimacy of the law and forces legislators to always think back to the foundation. So that's what that will be a requirement in the writing of every law. So in the writing of the law to limit the speed in federal highways, there would be something saying this is to protect lives. But because the protection of lives is not a constitutional concept, then there is no backing of that law. Every law must be traced back to this. So as we're writing this, this should be a comprehensive thing. If you think that there's a law out there and the law is legitimate, you know, you feel in your heart, you perceive with your mind, your understanding, yeah, this law is real and it's valid, but you can't trace it back to something in the Constitution, that means that we have missed something in the Constitution. Now, I would dare say, and I say this with humility, even though it may not sound like it, but I would dare say that the 10 pillars that we're laying out in this and the next snippet are enough and comprehensive enough to cover everything. And those five rights that I always mention in other snippets, which will be the second set of five pillars, I believe are enough to define every right conceivable, the right to vote, the right to whatever right you feel is out there. Can be traced back to those five. It's like those are the five fundamental elements from which all individual rights are derived. And the same with the five pillars that we have discussed here. Every element of authority can be derived from these five basic pillars. And there's no need for more. And I could be proved wrong, but I don't think so. So that's basically... it for this snippet. We have discussed the first five pillars that the Constitution will be founded on. And in the next audio snippet, we'll hopefully be discussing the other five pillars, which are the five rights of the individual, and going into more detail on what those rights are all about and how they, in one way or another, relate to things that are going on in the present or not going on, because we have such a flawed constitutional system that needs to be completely revamped, destroyed, and redone to save this nation. I don't know how long it will take, but I believe it will happen at some point, and it won't be easy, but it can and it will be done, despite the fact that this nation seems to be filled with idiots and people who don't understand and don't want to recognize the truth. But something will happen, and things will change somehow. Thank you.